thing.
Okay, this was supposed to be a cloud, so I thought I'd better have some clouds in the picture, which I guess this is a picture of baroclinic instability, basically storm front. So we are going to be talking about baroclinic instability, probably not so much about clouds, although I suspect some of the methods I'm going to be talking about may have some implications for clouds, and perhaps we can discuss that. So, in the normal way of doing subgrid modeling, you tend to have a number of parameters and some sort of, quite often, some fairly heuristic ideas. What I'm going to try and do here is to derive the subgrid parameterizations systematically and then apply it without any parameters. So zero parameters. And then I'm going to look at the scaling laws of some of these grid effects. So try and generate universal scaling laws and then compare the LES with the DNS as a benchmark. So this system I'm going to start with is I'm going to start fairly simply because I want to go through the turbulence closure equations, which is the hard way of doing this work, and then I want to do an easier way, which is using a stochastic modeling approach, which will generate the same results, and I'll show how the connection between the two comes. And I'll show some results initially just for the barotropic vorticity equations, and then to go on to layout systems in the atmosphere and ocean. And if I get a chance, I'll talk about other things like inhomogeneity and other things at the end. But that depends a lot on how we go. So the problem that we have with subgrid modeling goes back to the very first model, Magorinsky 63. I have a picture here from Minabe et al. And what they did was they changed resolution in these GCMs. And as they do, they're using a delta to the fourth. I think it's 1 × 16 meters to the fourth, second minus one. But anyway, it doesn't matter what the particular value they use is. As they change resolution in terms of wave numbers from 15 wave numbers to 30 wave numbers, the spectrum changes. And so what you see is that the spectrum here is at 15. This is actually wave number one. They don't go to zero. This is sonal wave number. They don't go to zero in this graph. But so this is the level here of energy in that case. And the spectrum's up here. And at higher resolution, the spectrum comes up here and it falls down there. Now, what we noticed, we did some studies in the 70s and stuff. To try and understand what was going on there. And it turns out that if you have the inviscid, if you'd have del squared equals zero, inviscid case, and this is just barotropic vorticity equation, you can calculate what the equilibrium, statistical mechanical equilibrium solutions are, the climate of these systems, either by just integration, or you can actually calculate it analytically, because there is an exact theory for it. And what you show that in the inviscid case, you have the same sort of behavior. So the dynamics wants to go into these states. So if your subgrid model is incorrect, the dynamics will take over and it will do its thing. And that's the problem. So now, the reason why the dynamics is doing that is because it's trying to equipotential entropy. And, you know, this is two-dimensional turbulence, so you've got energy and entropy conservation, and you've got Fjordhoff theorem, or you can look at it in terms of statistical mechanics, and you can solve the statistical mechanics equilibrium solution, and you can show analytically why you get this behavior. And this has been a problem with general circulation models from day one till now. These were some results we did at that time. This is with a more modern model. It's about 96 again. And as you can see here, that as you increase resolution here, the energy at the larger scale, this includes zero in this case, the energy at the larger scales increases. What happens is that the dissipation also pulls the tail of the spectrum down. When it pulls the tail of the spectrum down, it up pops energy at the large scales. So you have this counterintuitive idea that when you dissipate, you get more large scale energy. The system works like a fulcrum, and it's because you have the two conservation laws of energy and entropy in the system. When you make it inviscid, in this case, if you remove the viscosity so the tail pops up, the large scale energy drops down. So quite counterintuitive behavior. Now, so if you want to try and overcome this problem, you have to do something probably a bit more systematic than the ad hoc sort of choosing a dissipation parameter and some ad hoc strength of diffusion. Try and actually solve this problem in a systematic way.
So the meter now, they cannot be, that must be kilometers, right?
The what?
Is that really 30 meters only?
What is?
On the bottom, on the axis, what is M?
Wave number M. M. PMN.
Where's the forcing scale?
The forcing scale?
Yes.
The forcing scale in this system would be in the large scales and then producing backlinking instability, which would be coming up in about wave number 10 or something like that.
Wave number 10. So this is the forcing scale?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let's just start with the barotropic vorticity equation. So this is just, rather than going U and V, we'll convert it to the vorticity equation, so we have one equation to look at, and that makes it easier. So we have the Jacobian here, the sinal velocity and meridional velocity, or the east-west and the north-south velocities are defined in terms of the stream function. The stream function then defines the vorticity. Very simple system. So we'll start with that for the theory. And we'll go into, in this case, we can do it on a torus, on doubly periodic domain, and on a sphere. We'll do both. We'll formulate in the same way. So we do a spectral representation, expanding Fourier series, do the spectral transform, and we have an interaction coefficient in the system. We have Rossby waves in the system, so it's rotating with Rossby waves in it. And we have, this is what the interaction coefficient looks like. We do it on the sphere now. So on a sphere, beta corresponds to B now. It's just a different thing. And that should not be a Y, that should be a mu, sign of latitude. That's a typo in there. We expand in spherical harmonics. And I'll map it back into the planar case by redefining things here. So I'll define K as Mn, and PMn is the Legendre functions, and I'll define minus k just with a minus on the m, not on the n, because n is always positive. And then we have the same equation as on the beta plane, except there's an I that sits at the front, and that doesn't make any difference when you do the statistics. So we map both the beta plane and the sphere onto the same system. And the only thing is that because the Laplacian operator is different, where you get a k squared on a beta plane, you get a k into k plus 1 on a sphere.
I'm just curious, is it consistent to use the beta plane approximation as well as this full spherical harmonics?
Well, I tend to work with spherical harmonics. A lot of people don't like them. And so I tend to work with both. So it's much better to do it in spherical harmonics, I think. But the algebra becomes a little bit more complicated. Your interaction coefficient here, as you can see, is a little bit more complicated because you've got all these integrals over the Legendre functions. Okay, so we come to the closure problem, and you all know, very well familiar with this. The problem is, how do you close the system of equations for quadratic nonlinearity? And the problem is that each level you get the next one. So at n, you need the cumulant for moment for n plus 1. So how can you, what attacks can you do to the closure problem? Well, The earliest methods of solving these problems were done in quantum field theory, and they involved Feynman diagrams. This approach was also taken by Wilde in our field. The earlier approaches were heuristic approaches by Craignan, who basically summed the perturbation series and said ad hoc, we will make the lambda parameter 1, and we will make the bare propagators, which is basically the covariance matrix, and the response function matrix, we'll make them to the full ones, and we'll leave the interaction coefficients as it is. And that's the DIA. That's how the DIA was derived. And then I said, while then underpinned this with the Feynman diagram approach from quantum field theory, subsequently the Swinger-Dyson approach was generalized to classical fields by Martin, Sidgwick and Rose. And it turns out the classical field theories are much more difficult than quantum field theories because you have two fields. You have the adjoint field as well as the field that you actually need to take care of. So it becomes a two-component system, spinner system. And the other thing that we have is we have interaction coefficients which are coefficients rather than just constants. So that makes life fairly complicated for us in turbulence. And then finally, the path integral approach is the most general approach you can use, which allows you to tackle any sort of problem pretty much with any sort of interactions that you like. And that was developed originally by Feynman and then applied in this field by Fithian and Jensen particularly. So they're the sort of formal approaches you can do. The heuristic, I've sort of done a review of the heuristic way, and in two pages you can actually derive these equations quite simply. So it's not that hard really. So the issue is then we want to take the given field, we express it in terms of the mean and the deviation from the mean, and then we have covariance matrix or the cumulant, the response function, and the three-point functions. They're all coupled together, and of course the three-point function will involve the four-point function and so on, and how you close it is the issue of the in the direct interaction approximation. You use a sort of quasi-Gaussian approach and you go from the three-point function to the four-point function, and you factorize that in terms of the two-point functions, and the two-point functions being the response function and the covariance matrix. And so these are the equations. This is for the covariance. This is now homogeneous, so this is the covariance matrix. And it involves now a nonlinear noise term and a nonlinear dissipation term. So you get this extra dissipation, which is what is parameterized in many of these heuristic theories. Quite often the noise term is actually neglected in closure theories. But from a structural point of view, there's the bare forcing function here, which is basically the stochastic force you might have in your equation, gets modified by this nonlinear term, and this term here, this dissipation term, the bare dissipation terms, gets modified by this damping, extra damping term. This is an integral term, but in a Markovian approximation, you would just get a norm. So what you have, from a structural point of view, is a renormalization of the random noise by a nonlinear term, which you should really parameterize. And it's certainly very important for predictability problems. And you also have your damping term here, which is the drain damping. So you can combine these in some cases together to form a net damping, and that's what's quite often used in heuristic models. And we'll look at it. Okay, and so that was the two-time covariance. You've got the single-time covariance is just obtained from this limit here in this system. And you have a response function equation. Now, the reason why you get these integrals is because you use a Green's function approach to solve the system, and the Green's function is a response function. And so this response function also arises because of the adjoint, because the classical systems are not self-adjoint, unlike quantum systems, and so you have a separate response function and a and you don't only have the fluctuation dissipation theorem at equilibrium or for linear systems. Now I just want to show how to do the renormalization program in a simple case when the integral differential equation is reduced to just differential equations. And we can do that by going from the direct interaction closure to the EDQ-on-M, Eddy-Damped Quasi-Normal Markovian theory. And the way you do that, we talked about the fluctuation dissipation theorem for a classical system only occur actually being valid at equilibrium, but we will apply it now out of equilibrium. So this is a fluctuation dissipation theorem. It says the decay of the covariances is like the decay of the response of how the system responds to perturbation. So the natural decay of in time is the same as if you give it a kick and see its decay scaled by the equal time covariance. Now, if we assume just a simple exponential decay of the response function, and we choose this particular sort of form here, we can show that's consistent with the Kolmogorov type theories and so on. It will give the right power law behavior, and it turns out that gamma is 0.6 will give you a good correspondence to simulations. So we have a more heuristic theory than we started with, and we'll just use that for now, and we'll go back to the more fundamental theory later on. So if we put these things into the integrals, we can then do, because we now have the response function, we can do the integrals. So the integrals that we had here, like for example this integral here now, these sort of integrals over time are now doable. We can do them explicitly. And they're done here, for example. So it turns out that the integrals that we come across, this involves three response functions. You can do them in terms of exponentials, and in the limit as time goes to infinity, you get this very simple damping form for the interaction of the of these terms. Okay, so once we've combined all that, we have then for the equal time covariance matrix, I'll go back here, so the equal time term here, it has this S function and the eta function, they're the ones that we will evaluate, that we're evaluating in terms of the triad relaxation time. Okay, so now, so we're back to the equal time now. So we've gone from a much more complicated system where we have two times varying because we have a response function, we have a covariance, a time decay, and we put all that into this behavior here in terms of time and this relation in the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And then we're back to a differential equation. From that, it's much simpler to see what happens in the system. So you have now this equation here, the time dependence of the entropy effectively here has the normal bare dissipation term, the random forcing term, and it has two extra terms here, which is the eta and the S, which is the nonlinear damping and the nonlinear noise terms, which we can integrate and calculate.
So let me ask a question. So
yeah.
So you use the fluctuation dissipation theorem.
Yeah.
Right. Which you're actually not allowed to use.
No. But I'm just doing this heuristically now to motivate the. Then I'll throw it all away and I'll do the full problem.
Great,
I'll do the full problem without any approximation. But I'll do this first.
I was just wondering when it breaks down, but
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to throw it out. So. okay, so we can calculate the nonlinear damping. So this is like a Markov limit. and we can calculate the nonlinear noise, and we can put them all together into this triad relaxation term, and we can calculate that even at infinity asymptotically and use that because that's steady state, and we can calculate everything like that. We can then compare it with the DIA. And we'll find that it gives much the same thing. Okay, now we come to the subgrid modeling problem. So whatever problem we've got, direct numerical simulation, closure theory, or whatever, the issue is still the same. So we start with a full resolution here at some t, which the reason I call it t is because I'm going to use triangular truncation in spectral space, because that is an isotropic truncation. So that's why it's called t. And so for M and N, or P and Q pairs, where the MP goes with the P, so the, and they lie in this range, that is the initial integration thing that we are doing. Let's just have a look. So in these sums, sums over P and Q, the limits are given here in terms of T. We're truncating it at T. So the MP lies between plus and minus P, and this P, which is the N, in the lies between those values here. So this is the typical spherical harmonics. They would lie in that sort of range. So that's what we start with. That's the full resolution problem. So we've gone to large scales, to the full resolution. And now we say, well, let's truncate it to a lower resolution. So then R is the same thing as T, where T is replaced by TR now. So it's smaller. Now, then the subgrid scales are the difference between those two sets. Now, this is a bit deceptive because the subgrid scales contain scales which go across the two. Okay? So the subgrid scales are scales that are interacting by themselves, but also that are going between the large scales and the small scales. So it's not just the subgrid scales, but it includes the cross scales. That's part of the problem. So now if we take the equations, and before we didn't have these terms here, we didn't have that term, and we didn't have that term, but we didn't have any R's here, and we didn't have any R's there. Okay. Yep. So before we had the same equation here, at full resolution we have this exactly the same equation. We have a tendency equation of the entropy, dissipation of the entropy, we didn't have that term. We had the random forcing term, we didn't have that term. But here we had a nonlinear damping term without the R, and the nonlinear noise term without the R, which is the forcing term in the system. Now we've said that T is equal to R plus S, and so we put the subgrid on this side and the subgrid here on that side. So we have the same equation as we had before, but now we're doing the renormalization problem. What we want to do is we want to renormalize this fellow by the nonlinear noise term, by nonlinear damping, and we want to renormalize the noise term by this term. So we're basically putting the structure of the equations to be the same as was before. So we have the same problem again, but with different terms. And so we then can take care exactly of how the subgrid terms affect the large scales. And we have exact representation. Okay, so then we define a drain dissipation through this nonlinear damping term, the subgrid nonlinear damping term, defined in that way, and the viscosity, drain viscosity, defined in the same way. We define the renormalized viscosity as the bare viscosity that we started with, plus the drain viscosity, damping, and the same with the viscosity. We define a stochastic backscatter, which is the noise term that came from the equations, from the S, here the nonlinear noise term, we go into a new forcing, and a renormalized noise, FR, which is some of those two terms. We can also define a backscatter dissipation if we want to go to a purely deterministic system, which can work sometime and will fail in many other cases. We can pretend that this forcing term is like a negative viscosity. And we can define a negative viscosity here as a backscatter dissipation, backscatter viscosity. Then we can define the net dissipation, which is what most people work with. Most parametrization that you actually work with, people work with a net dissipation. They combine the stochastic term with the deterministic term. But of course, that's not so good, because sometimes it produces numerical instability. It doesn't give you the right predictability properties, and physically, it's not the right thing to do. But we can define a net viscosity, a dissipation, a net viscosity, and a renormalized net viscosity. For some problems, I'll show you it works, and some problems, it won't work. Okay, so now we go back to this equation here. We've got this extra terms now in our things here, but when we redefine them, then we now have these two terms combined to the drain renormalized dissipation term. And these two terms, the renormalized noise term, we formally have the same thing on the other side, except we now have a lower resolution. So we got back to the same, and this is the whole purpose of the renormalization program, is to get the same equations, whether you're working with a renormalization group or perturbation theory. You try to get back to the same equations, the structure of the same equations, and that's what we have now. So this is what we started with here. We have a bare term here, and we have a bare forcing term here. We now have a... So with these transformations, we have the same problem again. And we have completed the renormalization program. And we have a system which should give you exactly the same statistics at the retained scales. We can check whether that's the case. For the, if we go back, if we forget about the E to QNM and go back to the DIA, and we can go through this whole procedure again, but now we've got integral differential equations. And the viscosities, now, the drain viscosity now involves these integrals, because it remembers where the turbulence, it remembers the history, the memory effects of the turbulence. The stochastic backscatter, again, remembers where it's been, and the backscatter viscosity remembers. But you can do the whole thing, and we've done the sort of calculations with that.
I have a question. Did it play any role that you chose the noise to be white?
No.
You could have.
Yeah. No, in the DIA, I don't choose it to be white. I mean, it's has a general form. But from some points of view, I mean, white is quite good. You know, I mean, we actually calculate the noise as red, and then we as coloured, and then we can simulate it using white noise quite well. So it doesn't really affect the subsequent simulations. So here we have an example of how well this works. So in the first here, this is just a wave number spectrum. Here I plotted 0 at 10 to the minus 1, just so because I want to do a logarithmic. So here I have an observation of January 1979 spectrum, and I have a simulation which is not exactly the same. As you can see, there's a little bit of differences here between the two. Which tries to replicate it. I mean, I've only run it for a short time, but so it's not that important. So we can regard one of those two as the truth. And then, basically, then we reduce the resolution from T63, so 63 wave numbers, down to 31, and they're scaled down by a factor of 10 on each one. And you can see, this is only a 100-day integration, so it's very short. I'll show you some much longer ones, which are much better in a minute. But you can see, essentially, that this is with a stochastic backscatter term, and this is with just a net dissipation term. In this case, whether you have a stochastic term or deterministic, doesn't really matter. But the results are, well, they're not perfect there, but you can make them perfect by running them for long enough. And I'll show you some in a minute where they've been run much longer. So when you go through this renormalization program, you can get the same statistics at the large scales when you do the subgrid modeling in a systematic way.
Excuse me, where the cutoff in the areas
come? Well, I said it's going from T63 to T31. So from 63 WAM numbers to 31 WAM numbers in M and N.
So the cutoff is right there where it comes down?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. The cutoff is right here. So you're going from, you're chopping out all those waves to here.
How much is the subgrid scale energy, for instance?
The subgrid scale?
How much energy is in the average solar scales, the effect of which you have to model?
Oh, you can make it as much as you like.
Okay.
I mean, I'll show you some in a minute. I'll show you some where we can take it from, like, you know, 504 to 10 or something like that. You know, you can take the whole lot if you like, or you can take a small amount. It doesn't matter.
And it works.
Yep.
Well,
it's set up. It's designed structurally to give perfect statistics if you run it for long enough. So if there's no sampling, this is the errors you see here are sampling errors. It's just, I've only run it for 100 days, but the other ones that I'll show you later have been run for much longer, thousands or something like days, and it's, so, okay, so that's sort of give you an idea. Now, this is how the drain viscosity I show here from
base. For the novice, can you explain why you're running it longer helps?
It's a sampling problem because we're doing the statistics to get the climate, right?
Just a number of realizations.
It's just you've got to go around enough edit turnover time so you've got good statistics.
So why does it depend on the subgrid?
Sorry?
You're saying you can move the subgrid scale. I mean, how far can you go in your T? I mean,
one
doesn't work, obviously. That doesn't work.
We haven't gone to one, but we've gone to 15. From 500 to 15.
Yeah. And it's different.
Oh yeah. I'll show you the
scales for the large scale.
Yeah. Okay. So here we have what the drain viscosity looks like. So now, most of the time when people have dissipation parameterization, they use del squared or something like that. In fact, you have to use much higher ones. I mean, what you see is it's very cusped. So everything is quite cusped at the end. And the backscatter viscosity goes back the other way. And the drain, the net viscosity, which is what is normally parameterized it's really a small difference of two large things. So there's a large stochastic component here, which we are representing by this backscatter viscosity, but it really is a stochastic term, you know, which you can translate back to a stochastic term. And so that is how the viscosities are calculated, and that's what's been used in those calculations. And this is the net viscosity. It also, what's interesting, it has a little bit of a negative bit here. So the viscosity is not purely positive. As you go to longer and longer inertial ranges, this thing goes to essentially zero. And in some of the things I'll show you, we will actually forget about the negative bit at all altogether. Okay, now, we're now going to go from closures to something much simpler. But I want to go to stochastic models because one of the interesting things, if you look at the DIA, direct interaction approximation, or the EDQ and M, I'll show you the, they have an underpinning large amount equation. So you can formally derive them, if you like, but once you have, you can show that this equation, this set of equations, will reproduce the statistical closure. And so basically this equation here, if you start with this for this equation here with this damping term here and with this extra noise term here, so this goes, this is the E that we talked about before, and this gives you the S term that we have, the nonlinear noise term. So eta is given by this form, the nonlinear noise term is given here as a random stochastic term with this statistics defined here. So the covariance of these zetas is the covariance matrix or the cumulant, and similarly here these rows that goes into this noise. This equation will reproduce the BIA closure, and there's a similar one for the E to Q and M. So that suggests we could start, we could do all this work with stochastic models rather than doing the closure formulation, because the closures are quite cumbersome. I mean, they're quite, and for complex models, difficult to formulate. But the stochastic model approach is a simpler way of getting very similar results, and I'll show you how that works next. Okay, so we're back again. Recall, we start with this full resolution here again. We reduce the resolution again, and we calculate the subgrid scale exactly as before. Now, in this case, I'm going to go to a general multivariate variable, Q. So basically my vorticity equation that I had before, which is field of that, I'm going to write that as a vector. So all these vorticities I'm going to replace by a more general equation. You can make them what you like, general ordinary equations in Q, which have an equation like this that satisfies some nonlinear equation, doesn't matter what it is. We split the tendency into the retained scales and to the into the subgrid scales. We write the Q as an average, which can be like an ensemble average, a time average, or something, and the perturbation from that. And then I write the subgrid tendency now is written as a mean subgrid tendency here, which I just keep as a mean eddy force on the mean field, on the ensemble mean field, plus the fluctuating part here. And it turns out from many of the problems we're looking at, this term is not that important for systems with large Berkeley, but we can calculate that if we wanted as well. But I'm just gonna, what I wanna do is to write now what we found before in the closure calculation was that the subgrid tendency consisted of a dissipative term and a stochastic term. And this is the drain dissipation term that we had before, and this is the stochastic backscatter term that we had before. So I'm writing now this general matrix for the subgrid term in terms of a matrix dissipation term and a subgrid backscatter term.
Q? Q there?
Sorry?
Q was just the set of variables that you have?
So I've just gone from the, you know, barotropic vorticity equation to any equation you like.
Yeah, yeah, but in that vector, do you include the whole grid, the whole globe, or just at that point?
Anything. Can be anything you like. This is the spectral. In this case, the J can be, it could be grid points, anything you like, or levels, or field variables, or whatever. I'm thinking of this as a spectral variable, but you could make it an X variable. But for some of the argument that's follow, I'm assuming that it's a spectral variable. I'll show you when I come to that. Okay, so the question is now, how do we close that system? So we have this system of equations before we close it with the closure theory. Now we're going to do it from the direct numerical simulations, from the statistically direct numerical simulation.
The last line, right hand side, you have the damping term and the forcing term. So if that separation, just some results or the expected form you want.
Yeah, that's what I'm writing it at. Yeah, I'm writing it in that form. We know that from the closure theory, that's the form we want. Okay, and it's from the QDIA, even from the inhomogeneous closure theory, from the QDIA that we worked on, it comes in that form as well. I can give you the general theory if you like. I've got the mathematics from the closure theory that gives you that form as well. Now the question is, this expression here for D, how do I get this? Okay, so this is the expression that I claim D has to satisfy. Now this is like Gauss's theorem of least squares, but this is Gauss's theorem of least squares for systems with memory effects. So if you do sequentially Gauss's theorem and you take time steps to be longer and longer or shifted, and you sum them, you will get this form. So in the case when there's no integral here, and there's no integral here, this is the least squares fit, best fit. So if you have a stochastic equation, you have a stochastic equation of this form, and you want to find D for a time step, you use Gauss's theorem of least squares, that gives you the D. This is Popp's, lots of mathematical expressions work on that basis. So if there was no memory effects, we would just use Gauss's theorem of least squares, but because we've got memory effects, we're going to do this with memory effects. And this is the generalization of Gauss's theorem. So this is where the integral come in. They remember, the turbulence remembers where it's been. So this is my expression for the D. It's a minimization process, if you like, but a generalized one. And we have also, of course, the subgrid matrix from here, from F, is the covariance of the noise with Q cap, and you can express that in terms of the covariance of F by itself. And so to close the system, so this equation gives us D, generalized Gauss's least squares, and this expression here is the entropy tendency.
The averages are over?
These ensembles, or times, or you know, whatever, yeah. A running window, probably.
DD is a function of Q.
Sorry?
I mean, DD is a function of Q hat. How does the Q hat stick to
it? What?
Before, in this slide before, I just might be the only one who doesn't get it. So you do so the Q is still there, right? So the Q, you sum up all Qs, or what do you, how does it?
Sorry?
Your function DD, your dissipation frame term, right?
DS?
No. So DS is a big bigger, the Q, also Q of S.
Yeah.
Okay, this is how you eliminate the Q, okay, yes. So you degrade all Qs, which are below a certain base number, or?
No, the Qs, I'm integrating Q in time. This is in time.
Oh, this is in time.
This is time. This is a memory effect.
Okay.
I'm remembering this. I'm going back to the integrals. See, these are the time integrals. I want to keep, because turbulence remember where it's been, right? So I need to remember.
Oh, Q is just a variable, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Just the quantity, whatever it is. Yeah.
Okay, so basically, having got the Ds then we can use the Lyapunov equation, which basically says that the entropy tendency, if you like, is given for the subgrids are given by that, and then we plug in the expressions here and here, and these are the Hermitian conjugates, so this is just a matrix equation, and so you get the covariances here of the Qs with the Ds before and after, and you get your F. You know your Ds now, you know this, because you know your spectrum, so you can calculate F, and your system is closed, and you've solved the subgrid problem for the system of equations. It turns out, as we said, that in this calculation, F is assumed to be colored noise, but for many practical purpose is once you've calculated, you can then express it. You can't calculate it as white noise. You have to calculate it as coloured noise, otherwise you would not get this expression. But once you've calculated it, you can, if you like, simulate it through white noise for some purpose, if you're not particularly interested in decorrelations, for example. Okay, now again, we can go to a deterministic formulation. So we can combine, in some cases...
So the philosophy, I'm still a little lost. So the, quite lost. So when you say you get the, you solve the subgrid scale model, or the subgrid scale.
But we formulated and we can now solve it.
Well, you will show us how.
Yeah, we'll do that next.
Okay.
Yep.
So you can get an example.
Yep. So now we're just going to do the deterministic form as well. So basically, we can, from the stochastic backscatter here, we can find an equivalent drain dissipation, which is negative, and then find a net dissipation like this. And then if net dissatisfy that's equivalent to just assuming that the subgrid term is just written like this, not a stochastic term, but just a linear term, and its form is then given down here. Yeah. So we can go to a, but you can only use that sometimes. And okay, now this is the make or break part of the problem, because up till now these matrices, this is a very large problem. You've got the tyranny of dimensionality hitting you again. And if you look at the inhomogeneous closure problem as formulated by Craigman, for example, it's intractable, as he said in his papers, that you cannot solve it because it's just too big to do. It turns out that even though the covariance matrix is completely general, the Jacobian associated with it can be factorized. And it can be factorized into a dissipative term which is homogeneous and a field term which is completely inhomogeneous. And once you realize that you can do that, that turns, at least for all the problems we've looked at, to be a very good approximation. We get pattern correlation of 0.99999, you know, using this approach. So basically, to make the problem soluble, then these general dissipation matrices are assumed to be diagonal in one of not in these variables up here, not in the levels or the field variables and whatnot, but in the spatial variable, in the spectral space variables. So they're quasi-homogeneous. once you make that step, then the problem becomes tractable to actually solve in terms of the statistics.
Do you mean, so that kind of approximation is made for all magnitude of k?
Yes, for everything I'll show you from now on, that this has been the approximation that's been made. Okay, so now this was the closer results I showed you before, and we have similar ones for the DIA, EDQ and M and whatnot. And these are the stochastic modeling results run for the same period with the same time step with the same everything. You can see there's not much difference in them. They haven't been run for very long, but I'll show you some much longer ones in a minute. But you can see there's very, very comparable results in the two cases in terms of agreement. There's not much difference between sort of, this is a 100-day average, it's a very short average really, and these at these scales the eddy turnover time is quite long, so we haven't really sampled perhaps enough. If you look at the stochastic model, as I said, this is only a very short time, you see the wiggles here, which gives you some idea that we haven't fully converged with the run, but you see it's giving you the same thing. When we run it for much longer, which I'll do in a minute, then you'll see that you get much better convergence. Okay, so now we'll go to the more complex model. And I've written this in the form where we can look at vertical velocities and maybe have some implication for clouds, I'm not sure, but we'll see. So we're looking at the quasi-dystrophic equations, and I'm writing them here first in terms of vorticity and potential temperature. So this is, again, just for two levels, but you could make it as many levels as you like from the, you know, but we're just going to calculate it here for two levels. So you've got the Jacobian term, you've got a beta effect giving you Rossby waves, you've got a vertical velocity term here, Coriolis parameter at a fixed dissipation and a relaxation to some sort of state, so you're relaxing to some sort of climate state. Potential temperature, again the Jacobian term, vertical velocity, dissipation and a relaxation to some sort of temperature term. Here. So we can convert that into a potential vorticity, so look a bit more elegant. So the Jacobian here is given again here. This is in spherical geometry. So lambda is longitude, mu is sine of latitude. This b is just a constant. This is a, gas constant and constant pressure. So you can write there's a relationship between the potential temperature and the string function, which means that the temperature gradient is related to the sine velocity shear, which is how the atmosphere is related. And there's this parameter here, which is a coupling parameter between the levels. And when you take and use all this, put it all together, you can then simplify your equations like this. So you can define the potential vorticity as the vorticity plus or minus this coupling constant with a difference in the between the string function and two levels. And you have then the Jacobian term, the beta effect, dissipation, and a relaxation to a climate state in your system. So that's the system we're going to look at here. So that allows for barycleaning instability, formation of storms, potentially formation of clouds, and other processes like this.
So how is the vertical motion? How is the vertical motion included here?
Just here. Okay, it's been eliminated in the potential vorticity equation, but once you have the potential vorticity, you can solve it back and generate the, through an omega equation, you can then generate the vertical velocity equation. That's why I put it up, to show you that the vertical velocity was in there. Okay, we put it into spectral form, and I've written it out here, just in terms of the Legendre wave numbers, M and N and whatnot, but also I've written it more in a simpler vector formation here with in the same form. So it looks like a beta plane or a planar geometry case. Okay, so now we've got, what I'm doing is I've got these forcing functions here for the two levels. So this is what I'm shooting for, and this is what I get. So I'm actually shooting for something stronger than, you know, because I've got to drag the flow up and generate turbulence and so on. So this is the flow field I have in a zonal latitude. I have the two jets that you see typically in the northern hemisphere and in the southern hemisphere at two different strengths. So at 250 hectopascals, it's stronger than at, say, 750 hectopascals. So, like, you know, at 12 kilometers is stronger than, say, at about 3 or 4. So that's the flow. The FL value here, which is a coupling layer thing here, is relatively small in the atmosphere, which means that baroclinic instability occurs at around about 10. The Rossby radius of deformation is about 14 or so, and baroclinic instability occurs around about wave number 10. And with that approximation, in this situation, the deterministic form will actually work. But for the ocean, which I'll show you in a minute, it doesn't work at all. Okay, so now we've done the same for the two-level case, and we've run this for longer. So if you look at the, without any subgrid modeling, the tail here lifts. As you reduce the resolution from 126, MAME number 126, back to 63, I'm not showing you the end of it, which just goes off. As you reduce it from 126 to 63, without doing the subgrid modeling, the tail of the thing just lifts up as from here, as you can see. With the subgrid model parameterization, we've run it here for about 1,000 days, and you can see a little, few little spots where it differs a little bit, but not a lot. If you run it forever, I mean, in principle, it should give perfect results. I haven't shown you what the subgrid model looks like, because I'm going to show you that in great detail in a minute. I don't show you for the ocean, so I'm doing the Antarctic circumpolar current, which is one of the classical problems in oceanography here. In this case, FL is 100 times larger, so the coupling goes out to much, the eddies form at much, much smaller scales. They, instead of being about 10, they're out past 100. And in this case, I'll show you some of the subgrid model terms, but I'll show them in terms of the mean term, the average between the two layers, and the shear between the two layers, because you can see they're similar. So this is the average parameters that you need, and this curve here is the drain dissipation. The drain dissipation, and this is the net dissipation. You can see it's nearly zero, the net dissipation, because there's two big differences. There's another forcing, which I'll show you in a minute. The baroclinic term, which is, gives you the coupling, is again quite large. So you can't, the systems no longer become decoupled, but they're very much coupled. You've got cross terms here that are imaginary, so you've got coupling. You've actually got effectively a rotation of the flow between the levels that's going on in the system in terms of the dissipation terms. And similarly for the stochastic backscatter terms, you've got both the mean and the baroclinic, both the barotropic and the baroclinic components are quite large, and you have a, you know, it full coupling in terms of the wave number, in terms of the levels. And this result is using no dissipation. So this is the high resolution, which was originally wave number 252, truncated back first to 126 and then to 63. There's 63 here, and this is without the subgrid parameterization, and this is the higher resolution truncated back. So it's nothing like it. This result needs to be run for about 100 years, and we run it for six. We haven't converged, but we're going to run it for considerably longer. But you can see there's a bit of a sloshing here at some of the larger scales. The eddy turnover time is really, really long, so the system is still sloshing, but you can see we're getting much better results than with the without doing the subgrid modeling. Okay, so I come then to the final part of the talk, which is to develop scaling laws for the subgrid model. So we go back to the atmospheric case, and this is how a snapshot looks of it, you know, in the simulation. Yeah, so you've got your two jets wandering around in the northern southern hemisphere. You've got again your two jets in the top level, stronger than the bottom level. I'm going to look at two cases. The first one, I restrict the. Okay, we're back to the same equation as we had here. These are the equations we have here. We've got a drag term, and we've got a relaxation term here, as well as some dissipation term. Okay, so the drag terms, in the first case, I only let them go out to wave number 15, and I stop it. And in the second case, I let the drag, which is 20 days in the top level and 5 days in the bottom level, I let it go all the way out. And I'll show you why, what effect that has, just this little change. But I'm going to look at those two things. In the first case, we're very close to the comma, to the typical n to the minus 3 inertial range. It's 3.2, minus 3.2. For all intents and purposes, it is the inertial range law. With the extra drag, it results in the Stieber power laws. Now, sometimes you also find the Stieber power laws just because of coherent structures. So we're looking at both those cases because of that interest, and also because we want to map all of these cases onto the same thing. We want to map it all onto the same law. So we want to have a variety of spectra. Okay, so for case A, so here we are, here the simulation. This is approximately n to the minus 3. This is about 4.1. If you look at the entropy flux, and you see here nice inertial range, flat as a pancake, everything's looking like a typical inertial range. For the other case where we keep the drag provides you with a slowly decaying, almost constant term. Before you hit the final dissipation at the end. So you've got these two things. So what we'll do is we'll rectify this, we'll flatten it by a power law. So that's what we've done here. So we have the inertial range here again, and here we have this weak dissipation range flattened by n into nd to some power beta. So we effectively flatten. And we're going to call the entropy dissipation inertial range entropy flux, eta I, and in the dissipation range we're going to call it D. And there will be the references that we will relate. We will try and unify the parameterizations to those two fluxes. Okay, so this is basically how the subgrid thing looks like in terms of anisotropic case. I showed you some cross-section, sort of isotropized dissipation term. Here is haven't been isotropized, but you can see they are pretty much isotropic. And for much of what I'm going to do, I will be working with the isotropic versions of the power laws, of the dissipation parameterizations. Okay, so as we change resolution, this is how the net viscosity changes. So we have wave number going from wave number 504, 225, 126, 63. We've even gone back to, you know, much lower than that, 15, I think is the lowest we've gone to. But these are how the isotropized net dissipations look for level 1. I'm just looking at level 1 now. Level 2, we'll combine it all together in a minute. If you scale these terms by n over ntr, and this with the maximum value, you can map them onto something that looks, it all sits in this corner down here. And then we're going to work out what these, they look more or less exponential, so, or power laws, and we're going to fit a power law to them. Okay, so this is the Craiglin, this is like Kolmogorov, but for two-dimensional turbulence. So we have the energy spectrum is given by this power law, with the entropy flux to the two-thirds and a constant like the Kolmogorov constant, but from Craiglin and Batchelor. And from Leith, that means that the viscosity should scale like the entropy flux to the third power in the inertial range. So we're going to use that scaling. And we're going to assume that the dissipation, the net dissipation at a given level depends on the value at the end times a power law, n over ntr to some power rho, which means that for large n's and for large truncations, which is what we're working on, this goes like squared, so the viscosity we just have the n into n plus 1, we're going to forget about the n into n plus, just make it n squared, goes like this with a minus 2 power law. So we're going to fit that to the curves. And so here they are. So this is the maximum dissipation scaled by the entropy flux, the reference entropy flux, which for case A will be the inertial range, and for case B will be the weakly decaying range, flattened. Okay, and as you can see, they all lie on this line here, and the exponent of the fit all lie on this line here, and we're going. It's a whole lot of, you know, truncations back. I think we're here at certainly 31. The lowest we have is 31. Let me go on down. And up to 504. And we put our bare viscosity, we also put that on the line to be consistent in our simulation. So that's put back on the line as well. So that's for the net. And so we have then power laws. And because we have this dependent on the entropy, it also works for levels. So as you go up and down levels, you also unify it in the levels. When you come to the backscatter and the drain dissipation, they involve those integrals, as you remember. The net dissipation is the difference between the two, and it doesn't actually depend on the integral dropped out. But for the others, you depend on the integral, and so you're going to. So you need to know where you sit on the integral, so that you have the converged. So your results are converged. Your integral. You need to converge your integrals, and that has to do with how the correlation, the self-correlation between the field at two different times behaves, and the subgrid tendency correlated with the field at a given time. And they're shown here. The cross correlation between the subgrid tendency and the field, and the order correlation between the field itself. So you like to be somewhere in the converged range out there. So if we do that, we can plot, we can calculate those results for different integration times. We can take the integration times out at different times, and we can see how our drain dissipation converges. And if it turns out, we can actually, by scaling, collapse everything onto the same curve pretty much. And as long as we are past this point here, so tau times TR is greater than 100, then we're converged. And so all our results are in the converged region. So here we are. So now we're going the same results that we showed before, but now I'm showing the drain dissipation and the backscatter dissipation, again scaled by the entropy flux to the third power. And we have, as you can see, the backscatter minus the backscatter sits pretty much on the net line. The dashed line is what the net sits on, the net viscosities. And in fact, the drain is twice, effectively, as we can show you. And the power laws are slightly different. So here we are. So essentially, this is the scaling law, that the drain viscosity at the end point is twice the net viscosity at that point, and is minus twice the backscatter viscosity at that point. And the exponents are given here, which holds over that whole range. And here are the dependencies on the reference entropy flux. And so those results should hold for a wide range of different sloping power laws, different strengths of the flow, and whatnot. And when we So basically, when you actually apply those things, your spectrum basically get reproduced pretty much exactly. Well, more general applications. Well, I don't know. It may be you from this process for the quasi-dystrophic model, you can backstep to get the vertical velocity in P space, and you can look at updrafts and so on. You could probably do apply a similar technique to more complex model. We're going to look at primitive equation models and so on. But you can certainly step out from Q and the tendency of Q, which you have at each step, with stochastic backscatter. You of course have the vorticity, you have the temperature, and from the equations that we showed earlier, you can then backstep and get your vertical velocity as well. For various calculations of various things in cloud models. So that might be a possible approach to some things, but of course not things like nucleation and whatnot. Okay, so basically we've developed a stochastic model which basically can do pretty much the same as closures. It's much more flexible because you don't have the overhead of generating the closure models, and you can apply it to lots of different situations, inhomogeneities and so on and so forth. We have also done things with inhomogeneous closures, which I haven't talked about, but where we can get general same sort of results. Two important things is that it seems to me that it's very difficult if you have a complex problem, for example, like flow or topography and so on, to do it in a heuristic way. It's difficult enough that if you actually can have the machinery to do it in a systematic way. People have tried that in the ocean for flow or topography, Greg Holloway has and so on, but it becomes very difficult. And I think one of the problems we've had in with GCMs is people have been trying to do heuristically tune GCMs at each resolution, they retune them. That's the fact, and it seems to me that it's sort of a very tedious way of trying to look at this problem. This does provide a more systematic way of looking at subgrid. These subgrid terms, of course, are given by the same equations, which makes it simpler. You know, we have the same equation, we just take the equations out. We don't change the equations. It does provide a systematic way of approaching these problems.
Thank you.
Questions? About that cusp, is that because you use a very sharp cutoff at the separate scale?
We're using a sharp cutoff because if you don't use a sharp cutoff, I don't know what you do. Because I mean, it's very hard to know. I suppose you can have wavelets and all sorts of generalized functions, but having it in wave number space makes life so much more easy than having some, you know, because you can. Without that, it's very hard to say that you actually get full agreement. You know.
But then one wonders whether that is an artifact of the particular cutoff you use, or if you use some other cutoff, it will go away.
If you use spectral cutoffs, if you don't have a spectral cutoff, you don't have a separation. Uh-huh. You don't have a separation of scales.
Yeah.
And then you could have anything.
Yeah.
If you have a spectral cutoff, you have a separation of scales. Yeah. You know this is in and that's out.
Yeah.
Otherwise you have
diffuses
across. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And then you know, I don't know what your answer is then.
Then you don't know what is a subgrid scale.
Yeah, you don't know what a subgrid scale is then. Yeah.
So do these models get the fluctuations right? When you showed us this, that you get kind of the spectrum
yeah
pretty well.
So that means it's actually, you know, temporal fluctuations in your circuit.
Well, if a
circuit, you're mistaken, it's a riot. I mean, I don't.
Well, I mean, effectively, we know that the spectra and so whatnot. If you wanted
this
to,
it's all spatial, right? I see time is integrated out or something. I mean, what about time? Temporal behavior.
Temporal behavior depends on, I mean, if you represent the noise by colored noise, you should get the right colored noise statistic.
You should also be able to get the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, we have run the closure models, which with the integrals, and compared them with DNS. I can show you the results. We get, for Rossby wave dispersion over 10 days, so we start with a mountain. We have a mountain. We hit it with a flow, generates Rossby waves downstairs, and we look 10 days after, and we see the Rossby wave train pattern correlation 0.999949s.
So these. I mean, one of the things that I worry about also is, for example, systems that are not quite as high dimensional as turbines. You don't have this large scaling range, really big arc convection where you see very stable. It's called spatial temporal chaos, which we send with some of this because you have the three mode interactions, you have all that stuff there.
Yeah.
But just you don't know whether there is a subscript scale that you're allowed to cut off. Because it could be, right, that you only have to go to mode 10 and that's it.
Well,
we solve everything down to about 64, 125.
For the atmosphere, we own the advantage in that you have this long inertial range out past about 15 to 20. There's not a lot going on other than inertial range. For the ocean, you know, you're out like 100, 150, wave number 100, 150.
So this is actually not very,
you're a long way out. And in the ocean, the problem is the baroclinic injection is out there. So then you've got you've got a minus 5/3 law going back this way, and you've got your entropy cascading inertial range going that way, and you've got the cross regimes. So it's much more complicated. Yeah.
Right. So these techniques could be applied to spatial temporal systems. Awesome.
I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be, because I mean it's a fairly general, there's no restriction on the equations. The only restriction is on the solution, as I said. The advantage we have is for the problems we've been looking at, we know that Jacobian can be factorized essentially into a homogeneous dissipation term with an inhomogeneous field term.
And that one would have to show for the other problems.
You might have to show that. We know in our case that this is exact. I mean, this is exact at equilibrium, at any equilibrium, however strong you like it. But also we know that for small topography and for small mean fields, it also becomes exact because it becomes like homogeneous turbulence. So in those limits, and in terms of the simulations we've done, we found it always to give very good approximation.
But the oceans, as you said, these models are not yet.
The methodology works equally there. Well, there, that's not the issue. The issue has to do with the horizontal homogeneity, not with the baroclinic conversion.
Okay, I understand.
Not with the baroclinic conversion. It's whether the system more or less becomes more or less layered or not, or whether it's very strongly coupled. That only affects whether your matrix in the vertical direction is coupled, not the horizontal.
Can you say something? You know, the computations, they seem to be simpler with noise than without noise.
Sorry?
The computations, they seem to be simpler with noise than without noise. Can you say something about that? Why the stochastic system seems to be simpler than the classical, in some sense?
Simpler?
Well, yeah, at least more transparent from you.
If you look at the structure of the equations, If you look at the structure of the statistical equations, there's one term that's positive definite, which is always an injection term. You can show that the S term is positive semi-definite. And then you've got a dissipation term, which is a drain term. So it always splits up into two terms from a structural point of view. You can combine them, which is done in most cases, into a net viscosity. Most people don't have a noise in their equations. They have a net term in there. And you can get away with it if you're just interested in the climate, but not in predictability, because if you remove those scales out there, it means that they've got a back injection that you are not taking care of. They have two-way interaction between the subgrid scales and those scales. If you remove the stochastic term, you're removing entropy from getting back in. So you're getting artificial predictability. So from a predictability point of view, you really should have a noise term in the system. But you, from the climate point of view, just getting the mean, you can do it, but you can't do it with the ocean because it becomes numerically unstable. Because the problem in the ocean, if you're not resolving barycline instability and therefore not resolving injection, if you put an injection as a negative viscosity, it's numerically unstable.
Okay. So you're here for the rest of the week?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, and today we will have cookies.
Pretty sure.
Okay. So tomorrow we have two talks. I think one is given by Simon. Where is Simon? Right. You give one, and I don't know who is the second.
Salman
is the second.
When is Gunther giving a talk? I thought Gunther was...
Gunther delayed.
Oh, okay.
So first it was Ray's talk, then it was Gunther's talk, and now it's Simon's talk.
Oh, okay.
You know, the talks are fluid, so anybody else wants to switch?
Okay.
So we haven't done next week yet, so it would be nice if you would come up to me and say you would like to give the talk next week. That would definitely help me, because then I can time it and put in titles, and I don't have to run off to you. So this is the way it self-organizes somehow, right? When there are too many, I tell you no. Seriously. Okay, thank you.